Hello and welcome. This is the welcome to the session after tea time, or as it's known, nap time. My name is Bill Barnes, and I'm an engineer in Microsoft's Developer Experience Group. And that means I get to work with developers from companies big and small from around the world on our various technologies. And for the last 4 or 5 months, bots have been about 110% of my work focus. We've learned a lot. And this stuff really hasn't made it into the tutorials and the documentation. So I'm hoping to give you guys a leg up to learn what we've learned the hard way in many respects as we go through this. For me, this is an exciting time because I think, and many people think, that bots represent a paradigm shift in how people deal with computers. Probably not everyone's going to shift to using entirely bots, but it's now just a whole new channel for the way we write apps and the way users deal with apps. And I had first started at Microsoft in 1989, and I got to witness many of the other paradigm shifts. And we're going to walk through them a little bit right now. This is how things were when I started. And for many of us, this is still our preferred way of dealing with computers, right? It is super, super efficient. And it's very simple, really, because the computer's just saying, tell me what to do. And all you have to do is tell it what to do. As long as you know the secret code for telling it what to do, you have to know the commands, you have to know the parameters, you have to know the semantics, you have to know what not to do. The downside is very, very down with the command line. You can really burn yourself. And so it's the steepest of all learning curves, really, for interacting with a computer. Once you know it, you are the most efficient possible person on Earth. But I think we recognize that this wasn't going to work for everyone. And so eventually the whole Windows and menu paradigm came about. And this was much better. This wasn't tell me what to do. This was I'm going to tell you everything that's available, all your possible options. The problem with this is it doesn't necessarily scale really well, because the more options you add, the more you have to have menus and submenus of your submenus. And there, it's all there if you know where to find it. But now you have to start figuring out how the person on the other side of the menus, the person who designed that software, how they think about the world. A good example for me is I've been a Mac programmer for the last 10 years, and I've been using Keynote while I'm back at Microsoft, and I'm using PowerPoint. These are essentially the same apps. You know, they're like 95% the same functionality, organized completely differently. All right, so I had to just go and relearn it, and I get wrong-footed in every step. It's not dissimilar on the web. In fact, I think it's a little bit worse, because on the web, it's there somewhere. What you're looking for is there somewhere. It's clearly there somewhere. Maybe it's up top. Maybe it's in the menus. Maybe it's down below. Scroll to the bottom of the footnotes. And once you've learned one website, congratulations, you get to start all over again on the next one. These are two websites from my company. They're both from the same company, and they're totally different. And I think all of these kind of roll up to this, which is we're telling users, you have to go figure it out. You have to go look in the documentation. You have to hunt around. Now there is no documentation for websites, right? You just have to hunt around and find it somewhere. And for me, bots represent, in part, an opportunity to shift towards having the computer figure out the user. I'm pretty excited about that. We tried actually doing this once. It wasn't, like, the biggest success. We hope it goes better this time. So why are we having this conversation? I get asked this question a lot. Like, in a way, bots are nothing new. I mean, if you were playing Adventure or Zork, you're kind of having a conversation with a computer. What has shifted such that when Satya got on stage at Build back in late March, he said this is a huge focus for the company and a huge focus for him now. And I think it's a number of things. Partly it's that we now spend our time in these messaging applications. And not just like the kids, but I spend a huge amount of time in Slack. So I have a group that's distributed around the whole world. And Slack is our water cooler. It's where we meet. It's where we exchange a lot of technical and work information. It's where we exchange, you know, funny jokes, not so funny jokes. And the more time I spend there, the more time I don't want to spend anywhere else, because that's just a convenient place to be. And Slack is very smart, right? They have all these integrations. So now I have a GitHub integration. So when somebody makes a pull request to my repo, it tells me in my Slack, I don't have to go anywhere. And increasingly, I feel really annoyed if I have to go install a new app, if I have to go to a new website. I kind of want everything to come to me. And so this is kind of the bot thing, which is it's a conversational interface for a conversational world. We're going to where people already are instead of demanding that they come to us. Bots are also obviously an opportunity to physically speak to your computer using your voice. And there are situations where this is actually something you either should be doing or have to be doing. If you're driving, you really just can't be looking at a screen, shouldn't be looking at a screen or typing. There are also situations where, you know, you're assembling the new USS Discovery in space and the Federation space station orbiting the planet, and you can't use your hands for that. You've got to speak to it. So that's definitely a thing where bots are an advantage. It never ever hurts to follow the money. And I can think of at least a couple of places where money comes into place for bots. One is that bots are at least somewhat to quite a lot cheaper to build than a lot of the standard applications and websites we have now. There's just less visual design. There's not zero visual design, because bots can involve and should involve some visuals, I would say, but a lot less. And so if you've been in one of those sort of endless design committee meetings and what's our margin going to be and what should the gutter be, all that goes away. Some of it gets replaced. I don't want to overstate this. Some of it gets replaced. Some of the visual design gets replaced with conversational design, because you can't just sort of throw conversations at the wall and hope they'll stick. You actually have to get that right, and we'll talk a little bit about that today. Still, I do think there's going to be some cost savings. The other thing is that companies today, and this is not true, 10 or 20 years ago, companies today often spend a lot of time with their employees talking to customers over these text interfaces in some sort of customer service scenario. And to the degree, any degree that can be automated, the savings go straight to the bottom line. Now, a lot of companies come to us with this pipe dream that they're going to completely replace all their customer service stuff with a bot, and it'll be great, it'll be automated, let all those annoying employees go. And this is definitely a pipe dream right now. I mean, somewhere in the future, maybe. But there are definitely slices, maybe the first 30 seconds of a conversation where you're just trying to establish, what does this person even want? You know, what division should they be talking to? What person should they be talking to? Or maybe there's kind of some troubleshooting where you could, the computer's going to walk you through this troubleshooting, let me know if you have any problems. So there's just these parts where you could slice off. And so people are smelling that there's real opportunity to make / save money. Who knows what this is? What are these numbers? So this is an illustration of Moore's law. These are number of transistors on a microchip. And interestingly, it starts in 1995 when Moore himself had basically disavowed his own law. And he had said, I'm sorry, it's been a fun ride, but there are physical realities, physical laws, manufacturing realities. This has all got to stop. Hasn't. And so they continue to climb. So 1995, you could fit, you know, if everyone in New Zealand was a transistor, you could fit everyone in New Zealand on a chip. In 2005, it's the population of Bangladesh. In 2010, it's India. And last year, it's the whole planet. And it's interesting to ask, what are all those transistors doing? I mean, in 1995, we basically had Windows 95, right, which made the Windows interface, the Windows-based interface, ubiquitous. The one that Xerox invented and Apple popularized, you know, Microsoft just put it on everybody's desk and in every home. And in 2005 is about when Apple came out with the iPhone, right, where we have a new interface where we're kind of moving little rectangles under pieces of glass. But those interfaces haven't changed much. I mean, we're still kind of recognizably using the same desktop interface. We're still recognizably using the same phone interface. So what are all those transistors doing? It's almost a conspiracy theory. Well, I'll tell you, some of them are pushing the boundaries into like 3D graphics and VR and AR. That's some of what we're doing with all that computing power. But a lot of it is going into machine learning and AI, if you prefer. And so it's enabling natural language. And when we talk about natural language, we're talking about actually something very simple. We are not saying the computers actually understand what you are saying. They really, really don't. And it's really going to be a long time before they do. But we are saying something pretty simple, which is that there are often multiple ways of expressing the same idea. And in fact, you know, in any language, there's going to be nearly infinite ways of expressing the same things. So I can say this, I can say this. These all mean the same thing. And if I worked really hard and built a very specific model, I could pull this one off too. I want to walk you through how this actually works internally, because it's kind of important to understanding bots. I want to emphasize right up front that natural language is not the be-all and the end-all when it comes to bots. People tend to fixate on it because it's magic, and magic is awesome. But one of the things you'll hear me say again and again and again is that there's other things out there than natural language. It won't always be the right tool for the job. But here's what we do. So I said to many of you beforehand, this is kind of a high concept session. After this, I'm going to be handing over to Tiago, who I think is in the back there. And he's going to be next door. And he's going to pull out the C# and show you how he coded up the Azure bot. So if I wanted to build a bot to send him a message saying that I'm doing a great job because I'm doing a great job, I could say this, but I could also say this, right? They mean the same thing. And what we want them to do fundamentally is, in the end, when all said and done, is I just want to make a method call. I want to make a method call saying send a message. I want to pass a contact. I want to pass, can you see that right? Yeah. I want to pass a contact, and I want to pass a message. And so what we need is we need a system that will translate all those other ways, those very human fuzzy things, into something really concrete. That method call is called an intent. It's expressing my intention. This is what I want to achieve. So that's the function of these natural language things, is to produce that. The parameters are called entities, and they're called entities because they had to be called something. That's the best I can do on that one. So when you've got this first version, we now have the method call, and we filled in both parameters. And in the second version, it's the same thing, right? It's mapped down to that. And you could think of another dozen ways of expressing that, and they would all map down to the same thing. You also don't have to have all the parameters. You don't have to have all the entities. They can frequently be missing, and that's OK. You could have one. You could have the other. You could have neither. And here gets us to the next stage of bots. Because if you, as a human, were perfect and always expressed everything you wanted to, you wouldn't have to have a conversation. I could just say, do this. The computer would do it. We'd be done. No conversation. It's when something is lacking. So our colleague Matt told me the story right out of his home. His wife woke up Sunday morning and said, let's go out to breakfast. And he said, great. Why don't we go to this place? He names the restaurant. She said, oh, no. They don't have good Eggs Benedict. I want Eggs Benedict. And he said, OK, you want Eggs Benedict. How about that place? That has good Eggs Benedict. And she said, oh, no, that's too far. He said, all right. How about this place? It's not too far, and it has good Eggs Benedict. And she said, oh, that's too expensive. And it turned out that she had all these unexpressed constraints. And as a human and being fallible, she did not express them all. Those of us who, like me, are like quite introverted when not in front of a crowd, I don't really like having conversations with humans. And so I work really, really hard to make sure I give all the data. Like if I go to buy something, I will walk up and I'll be like, I want a 2016 model 6P option A. I'm paying in cash. Here you go. And then I don't have to talk to them anymore. It's perfect. But because we can't count on that, that's when the conversations happen. The conversations give us a chance to fill in the blanks and to disambiguate. So for example, back to the ice cream example, if I say I want ice cream, they missed a very important thing. They didn't say what flavor. But the computer can now ask, or in this case, a person could now ask. We answer, we're done, right? This whole thing, this is what we call a dialogue. A dialogue is almost always used to fill in these blanks, to figure out ambiguities or fill in blanks. So with that, let's dig in a little bit into what the Microsoft Bot Framework actually is. The Bot Framework result, in the old days, Microsoft, when it was coming up with some new platform, it would be a bunch of guys in Redmond in Redmond for like 2 years, and they would huddle in a basement somewhere and come out and say, here's our new platform, hope you enjoy using it. This was not entirely successful all the time. And I'm happy to say that in the new Microsoft, what mostly happens is the stuff we produce solves our problems or our customer problems, and there's a much tighter loop. And so this is how the bot framework resulted. The bot framework resulted because a bunch of us were writing bots, and we kept hitting the same problems over and over again. And that's the opportunity to have a framework, right, is to not repeat yourself, to fill in the blanks, to fill in the gaps, to solve problems. So to write a bot very basically, you've got a person, the happy face on the left. You've got some sort of message bus, some sort of message application ecosystem. In this case, I'm going to say Facebook Messenger. And then you've got your bot. And so the person is talking on their, let's say, their phone, using their app. They're talking to Facebook Messenger, and it is sending messages to the bot. So it's acting as an intermediary. And what's really happening, to go one level deeper, is that the bot and Facebook are both putting out REST endpoints. And every time the user sends a message to Facebook, Facebook sends it to the bot. And every time the bot has to send a message to the user, it sends it to Facebook, and that forwards it on to the user. We don't actually care what the protocol is. We don't even know what the protocol is between Facebook and the user. That's up to them. And this is basically the same for all those messaging interfaces. They just vary in the details. And so far, fine. You can just do that. But what you will find very, very quickly is that it is actually rather complex even to write simple conversations, bots have simple conversations. So let's look at a simple conversation. This is the Bureau of Licensing bot. This poor man's just trying to get a license for his pet fish, Eric. And so each of these are just message exchanges going back and forth across REST. Let's dig in a little bit deeper, but just to notice already that because these are HTTP calls, there's no state inherently in this. Probably Facebook is passing like a user identifier and a conversation identifier, so we've got that. But there's no way inherently to know what was the last thing we talked about. So the bot has to keep track at the very least of kind of where are we in the conversation. Let's go through it one by one. So first is a greeting. This is kind of easy. So now the user is going to say what they want. This is, in my mind, the best use for natural language is the very first step of the dance, is the user just saying what they want to do. Frequently in bots, there will be no need for natural language after that first expression of intent. They're just saying what they want to do. Now, this licensing bot might have 20 intents. It might have lots of different stuff that a user can do at this point. So this is the first kind of place where we're going to branch. We're going to run this through our natural language processor. We're going to grab the intents, we're going to grab any entities, and we're going to figure out what to do next. So in this case, we have determined that they're going to buy a fish license, the fish license intent, I guess. Now, for some reason, our bot needs to know the name of your fish, as one does. And so we're prompting them for text, and they're going to answer. This answer would not normally be run through natural language. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But really what's happening is they've just asked a question, they're going to get an answer. And so there's a context for this text that just came in. It's not right at the beginning where we're trying to figure out what to do. We've moved farther along in the process. There's some state. There's some internal state that has to remember, we asked you a question. This is an answer to your question. I'm going to have to do something with that. So at the very least, I'm going to have to like assign that to some local variable, or rather a global variable for this bot. Now we have another branch, which is, are they renewing a license? Or are they getting a new license? And again, we're going to have to interpret their response in the context of the question we just asked. Now, I'm not saying this is rocket science. I'm just saying things get complicated fast. And here, now that we've determined that they're renewing, we need another piece of information that we wouldn't need if it was a new license. And having gotten that, we can move to whatever the next step is. So our experience when we started writing these bots is the code went to spaghetti super, super fast. And we just needed a better structure. We needed to be able to handle the state from request to request, and we needed to be able to remember what was the situation before. Oh, we asked them a question. This is an answer to that question. Things like prompts get kind of complicated, kind of fast. There's lots of different ways you can prompt for stuff. You can put up buttons, or maybe say choose one for number one, choose two for number two, or they could type in an answer. And kind of wanted a unified interface for handling all those choices without having to redo all that code again and again and again. And the key concept for this is called a dialogue. And a dialogue is a unit of conversation. It's often a reusable unit of conversation. You can kind of think of it as a subroutine or method. And so each of these dialogues represents kind of an input and an output. There's something we're trying to achieve, and if all goes well, we'll get it out of it, and then it gets surfaced to the parent dialogue. So these things are often linear to hierarchical, depending on how you structure stuff. So this toolkit for building bots is called the Bot Builder, and it's the core of the bot framework. And so it's the first piece that Microsoft added to this, which is just to manage that conversation. And so far, that's all you need. Also, we had a hook to our own natural language processor, which is called Lewis. I have no idea what this icon is. And so you can plug in anything you want. Actually, and in fact, I should say the bot framework is all open source. It's all in both JavaScript and C# varieties. And so if you want to, you can write your own in Python, but you can also hook in at any level. One of my favorite things about this is really it's all unbundled. In fact, that's sort of a good word for Microsoft as a whole these days, is it's a la carte. You can use whatever pieces of this makes sense. And I've now seen partners literally replace every single part. Different partners replacing different parts of the bot framework, and it works well. So they did a nice job structuring those interfaces. So this is the toolkit that helps you build the bots, and it's the natural language parser. And if you've got multiple users, it's fine. Instead of like a single global variable to hold whatever the fish's name was, you probably have now an array or something, and it's indexed by the user's ID, and that's working. It's working okay. The problem is when your fish license bot becomes so popular that you need to run multiple instances of it. Now, again, a bot is just a web service. It's just a REST endpoint. So I can run all of them. And because it's all HTTP, everything goes nicely. The only problem now is you can't store state on an individual bot, just as if you were running a website, a load balanced across multiple servers, or a web service. And so for that, we have a store. We have a state manager where we can put all that stuff. Now, again, you can replace that with your own. Ours is just based on Azure Tables. It's a simple key value store. It's free to use. I think you get about 64K of storage per user per conversation, which is a lot. If you're storing videos per user, it's not going to work. But if you're just storing state, it's fine. I saw a partner replace this with Redis in about an hour. So it really is. It's a simple thing. It's a simple part to replace. So now you've got a bot where hopefully the conversations are a little easier to write. The state is being managed for you. You're hooking up to our NLP engine if you want. And you're talking to multiple users via Facebook Messenger. And you want to add some more channels. You would like people to use your bot to where they are. You don't want to make them come to Facebook if they're not Facebook people. I'm not a Facebook person. Maybe you want some Slack people. Maybe you want to allow SMS using a bridge like Twilio. Here's the deal. All these APIs, all the ways that these bots talk are similar, but frustratingly different, like just different enough that you are now coding a new thing for each channel. Also, each of these have different capabilities. It is not unlike the fun early days of browsers, when browsers manufacturers would just kind of unilaterally say, you know what we need? We need a marquee tag, right? And the other one would be like, oh, yeah, well, we're going to have a blink tag. And so everybody did these different stuff, and you had to decide, am I supporting marquee or blink? And hopefully you decided none of the above. So what the bot framework does is it has a new piece called the connector. And there's actually a different connector for each of these channels. And the connector is a unified interface, a unified API, so that if you are sending messages to Facebook, if you're sending messages to Slack, sending messages to SMS, for the most part, you're sending the same messages in the same format. And then those connectors do as good a job as possible of kind of down-leveling as appropriate based on what the functionality is. And right now, Messenger is by far the industry leader in terms of features. They're just adding them really, really rapidly, and everybody else is scrambling to keep up. And that's fine. So you can write to the richest possible version of these messages, buttons and cards and so forth. And then the interface will do a pretty good job of down-leveling. It can only do so good, but you have some ability to say to kind of customize and say, oh, okay, if this message is going to SMS, I want the text representation to be this instead of the automatic thing that happens. So that makes life actually a lot easier, and that alone is one of the reasons that many partners choose the bot framework, because really, as soon as you go from one channel to two, the level of complexity in your code goes way, way up without something like this. And that's the Microsoft, bless you, and that's the Microsoft bot framework. A couple other pieces that are sort of maybe part of the bot framework are a couple of the Microsoft clients. So down at the bottom is Skype. Both normal consumer Skype works with bots now, Skype for Business coming real soon. And the one up top is a web chat. It's an interface that right now you can plug into any website using an iframe. I'm actually the lead developer on that, and we're replacing that with a React component that people will be able to use either in an iframe or directly as a React component. And that'll make life easier, and that thing will be more capable than what we have now. And so that's the bot framework. It's what we'll be talking about today. You can, of course, in addition to plug replacing any part of this, it's just a web service. You can do whatever you would do with a web service. Anytime you have a web service, anytime you think bot, think web service. So you can access, of course, your own data. You can access your own services. You can access other people's services. You can access Azure services. You can access AWS. This stuff can be hosted wherever you want. It doesn't have to be in Azure. There's nothing like inherently Microsoft about any piece of this. And so it's really just there to help. And so we hope it helps. So I call this talk The Art of Coding a Conversation, because it has so far been very resistant in terms of coding bots to just lay down the law and lay down the rules. It's not entirely a science. It's a lot more like an art, and it's fuzzy. And that reflects, I think, the fact that it's in the fuzzy world of dealing with humans, who are the fuzziest of all possible creatures. They're very unexpected. They do weird stuff. And so the code ends up being a lot of, well, maybe this, and well, maybe that. And that means our very process of creating these things is fuzzy. So what I want to do is spend a few minutes and create a Lewis model. It's one of those things that people get caught stuck on. Once again, show of hands, who here has created a Lewis model? OK, just a few. Great. Those of you who know better than me can heckle. So I like the soft fade. Let's see, let's go into that. Nice. So this is Lewis, which is the Language Understanding Intelligence Service, is Microsoft's natural language parser. And one of the reasons people like it, I mean, they tell me they like it, so you can totally trust this alleged anonymous review I just gave. But they say they like it because it's easy to use compared to some of the other engines. So we're going to make one called My Personal Assistant. And if this totally fails, because Lewis loves timing their system updates to when I'm giving demos. Like, it's eerie, actually. So they call it an application. We tend to call it a model, because what's actually going to be created is a machine learning model. And if you don't know anything about machine learning, talking a little bit about it today, and then today at 2:55, I'm giving a talk on Microsoft Cognitive Services, and we'll delve a lot more into that then. So each of these models is going to be, let's see if I can get this right. We're going to create a model that will sort incoming, they're called utterances, because they had to call it something, into buckets. And these buckets are these intents. So we're going to create an intent and go back to this example I started with. We're going to create an intent called send message and give an example, tell Tiago I'm doing great. OK. So there goes. Now we have the first example of the first intent. We need some entities, though, so we'll add them here. We'll add a contact. And now I'll say this is a contact. And we add one more for the message. And there's the message. And so now we tell it. So the way you do machine learning is you give it labeled data. You say, here's the data. If you're trying to teach a machine to recognize happy people versus sad people, you give it photographs. Here's a bunch of photographs of happy people, and here's a bunch of photographs of sad people. And then it does its machine learning magic and creates essentially an algorithm that can sort things correctly into one bucket or another. This is sorting stuff into buckets. We have to give it examples. And what's really neat about modern NLP is you used to have to give samples in the hundreds, and now you can give it in the fives or tens. Like, it actually goes pretty fast. So let's see, what else can we say? We can say, send a message to my wife saying I'm running late. Okay, so there's my contact, and there's the message. And I'll tell it what the intent is. We're going to do about three or four more. So what else we could do? Let's see. Text my son saying you are as handsome as I am. It's true. Okay, let's give a couple more. Tell my boss that I deserve a raise. No, a promotion. If it's good enough for Jennifer, it's good enough for me. Okay, you'll notice it's heckling me at the bottom. It's saying too few examples, label more of these and try again. I don't even remember when these came up, so maybe we have enough so far. Oops, I already labeled that one wrong. So what we can do is we can look at all the utterances that have come in. And so this gives us a chance to correct those. Okay, one more. Send a text to my mom saying I love her. Aw. Man, she would eat that up. Okay, we're part of the way there. I think if we review labels now, will it tell us the percentages? Okay, so it's just really solid on that. We may have to add a few more to get our percentages up. We'll try something else in a minute. Here's the thing, though. We just have one bucket. Like, this is a terrible machine learning model because right now it only has one bucket. And chances are, if I just typed anything right now, it'd be like, okay, I guess that's a send message too because that's the only data you've given me. We need to give it something else. So each of those buckets needs at least something to compare against. So we're going to create, there's a couple ways to do this. There's a built-in entity called none. So I could just literally type in a bunch of random stuff. This is a great audience. This is a really great audience. What time is it? What time does the pub open? And I could just funnel those all into none. But more commonly, what you'd have is other intents. So we'll quickly create another intent. And since this is a bit of a personal reminder example, a personal assistant, we'll have set reminder. So let me know. Let's see. How about tell me? No, tell is going to be a little confusing. How about at 5 p.m., remind me, we'll do it this way, to go to the pub. All right, so there's an intent, but we're going to need some more entities. So now we have time. And we'll want something else. I guess they'll call it a title for the name of that reminder. Okay. And so now we've got a different. Oh, yeah, there's. Let's see. Remind me to walk the dog tonight. I'm actually New Zealand and cannot walk the dog tonight. Also, I don't have a dog. Okay. And then let's just go off the wall and say, I need to water the plants this weekend. Sort of sounds like a reminder. Okay. So now we have two intents, and we have a small amount of labeled data. I want to say that, just to emphasize, that natural language processing, at this point at least, is not really magic. It's not, if I say something totally off the wall that's unrelated to these utterances I've tried, the system is simply not going to understand it. But we'll talk about how to deal with that in a minute. So now that we have this, I'm going to train the model. So now it's going to do its machine learning magic, run all sorts of combinations of things and convolutional neural nets and things I don't really actually understand. And when it's done, training, which is actually nice and fast these days, it used to be a little slower, it's now published. And what that means is there's actually an endpoint, there's a REST endpoint out there on the internet that as long as you had the right credentials, in this case an ID and a subscription key, you could access and run utterances by our model and get back an intent. So let's actually try that. So let's see, I have to now think of a new way to say something. So tell my wife that I'm less nervous now that I've started. She was getting a little stream of text from me a few minutes ago. But you're a pretty nice audience, so it's all working out, I think. So this shows you the results. I actually love that right built into Lewis is a chance to try out some stuff and get the JSON response. So this is what you get back. It's pure JSON. It's really, really sure that it's send message. There's a chance that it's set reminder, and it's pretty low chance that I meant none. And in fact, this is how things typically work, and you can set whatever threshold you want. But it's usually, if you've done a good job training, things end up being pretty black and white. And here's the entity. It's done a nice job of securing the entity as well. It's actually very confident about the first entity and much less so about the second one. But there they are. So if we're building a bot, we can now take that intent, call our method, and we're done. What's that? Around the quote, isn't that funny? Yeah, it has to do with how it word breaks, and I don't know if that's a thing that they think is right or not. So now that we've so I'm going to update this published application. So that utterance we just tried out actually went in directly through the endpoint. So it wasn't doing some internal thing. It actually went through that REST endpoint, and as a result, we now have an interesting situation. So we have all the utterances we trained it on, but now we have a new input, which is indistinguishable from the input from any random user, and so it effectively is. As people use your system, you can actually see what they are, what they're doing. So I can, oops. Okay, so here is an intent. Here's an utterance that came in that wasn't the ones I trained it on. So here's my chance to change it. It happened, it got it right, so I don't have to, but I could completely redo this, and that would then go back in and retrain the model. So here's one of the things about NLP. It's not entirely a black box, or rather, it's not just one and done. You train a model, you work with it for a while, but then there's the things you didn't think of. There's the ways that people talk about stuff. that you didn't think of as you were training it. Lewis gives you a great opportunity to review those, to retrain your model. This is the world of machine learning, is constantly improving, and you keep improving the model to the heat death of the universe. You just keep on going. And so this is, there we go. That's our segment on training a Lewis model. So that's the good news. The good news, it really is easy to use. In fact, I don't know of another NLP engine that is easier for things like training and for improving. There is some bad news. Let's see, did the demo. So the first bad news is that, like, that was super easy for a couple of intents. Now imagine doing that for dozens and dozens of intents, not just the training, but the retraining. If you are in hundreds of intents, and by the way, if you're at hundreds of intents, you're probably doing something pretty complex, because of those entities, by parameterizing stuff, you can keep the number of intents down. But if you're doing lots and lots of intents, and we did work with a company that plans to use this for something like 300 intents, and that number will only go up, that's a lot of ongoing, essentially, maintenance of your model. And that may be totally appropriate. I just want to emphasize that it is actually a lot of work. The other thing is that I roughly think that intents correspond to answers. Instead of questions, they actually tend to correspond to answers, because there's often a lot of different ways to ask a question that yields the same answer. There are questions that work really, really well with bots, with NLP. So here are a few. Apparently, anything involving pubs works really, really well. I don't know why. These work because for each of these, you can immediately imagine, you know, a dozen ways of asking that question that are very kind of solid, and that do a nice job of preserving that entity in there. But then there are questions that really, really don't map well. I did make this up, but it feels like it could be true. So here's the thing. First of all, let's consider what answer are they looking for. Like, what are they looking for? They're probably looking for, we're probably a scenario where we've got like a large, complex document, and it's not the only one. Right? Because if there's one document like this, there's probably 1,000 more, even 10,000 more like it. Now think about the problem of how do you define all the questions that might possibly result in whatever the answer to that is, some large turgid tax document. You can't really. Like, you're just going to fail. You're going to fail on landing a good formulation of a question for all that stuff. Also, an incredible amount of work to do that. So in situations like this where there's large numbers of documents, it's just not going to work. And it's because of this thing about machine learning, which, again, it's about taking all these inputs and putting them to outputs. And by the way, if you know something about machine learning, I recognize this is a somewhat contentious statement, but I'm sticking with it for now because I like the picture. Few doesn't need to be few. Few could be hundreds, right? But if you're talking about 10,000s, especially in this example, probably you're on the wrong, well, you're definitely on the wrong track. And I do have some good news after all this, so stick with it. So we talked about how NLP is really good at the beginning for asking a question. It's a little less good for answering questions. So to go back to our example, when we've got asking for the name, there's Eric. It's great that they did this, but they could have spoken English and said, I called him Eric. His name is Eric. First of all, you can make this work. But now you're building a new model. You're building a new intent for Eric. And ideally, it's a different model than in this one, because, again, the machine learning is about sorting things into buckets. And you want that when it's sorting into the buckets, in the first one, you would never be talking about the name of your fish. And here, you'd never be talking about what kind of license you want to buy. It's contextual. You want the machine learning to have the right bucket so they can divide stuff up. Yeah. So you can make that work, for sure. But a better strategy is to try to create a situation where the user is not typing in natural language, because it is awkward to have to handle that all the time. And it becomes kind of a combinatorial explosion of answers. This is, I think, the thing that confuses people the most, which is, If you've got a database of stuff and someone says, where does the pub open, it's good about identifying the entities. But it doesn't know what those entities are. It has no idea. Because you saw the Lewis interface. At no point in the Lewis interface was there, connect me to your SQL database and tell me about your schema. Like, it just doesn't know. It's just about parsing the language. And in a way, that's actually a nice separation. But I just wanted to make the point that you have work to do. Like, at the point where you've extracted the entity, you're not done. You're going to have to figure out how to get at those records in your database. It's just not perfect. I mean, this is the essence of natural language. I don't do a good job parsing natural language from other humans. Like, I have real flaws, especially when I get anywhere outside of my comfort zone in terms of accent or how people talk. And so we can't really expect the most of it. And it just means when you write your code to understand that there's going to be failures. It's actually a natural part of it. It's not an exception. It's kind of normal. And there's good news. So I want to talk a little bit about search. If you walk away from nothing from this talk, but understanding that search is just as important as NLP, that'll be a great takeaway. So back to my database and the situation. The NLP does a nice job extracting out that entity, the pub. This is a great opportunity for something like Elasticsearch or Azure Search, which is basically hosted Elasticsearch, or even the built-in full text and SQL Server, to run that against the relevant fields in your database. And you get kind of a fuzzy list of matching the terms. It'll probably do a good job of dropping the out as a stop word. And now you've got a couple of records that match. And with a couple of records, you don't really need to do anything else. You can just give them both. And the same thing is true in this case where they misspelled something. A good full text search will allow that kind of fuzziness and will find a record and give it a probability. And you can be like, okay, that's close enough, right? So search is fantastic for this. Back to the tax example. So here we are where we've got a couple of examples of documents. This is a great opportunity, actually, for search, which is to take all those terms and run a full text search and see the ones that match, and it gives back a sorted list of the most likely answers. And in fact, what we have found is it's usually either in or out. It's not even close. This stuff is a good match or a terrible match, and usually nothing in between. So this is actually a really nice fit of NLP in search. Sometimes you can drop the NLP entirely. Sometimes you can just run searches on those queries, and it works really well. The thing about NLP is you want to avoid situations where the user starts to sort of expound, you know, poetically about stuff. You just want to let them give answers. And a great way to do that is to guide them, is to give them choices. Don't say what flavor you want. Give them choices. It's not just to avoid the problem. It also makes life a lot more convenient for them. We much prefer choices when we have. It's a lot faster if you can just tap on something and go. And a lot of these apps have rich interfaces which allow you to tap on stuff and go. And so I encourage you to use them. They are actually the key to making really great bots. And also, and this is going to, I feel, sound a little contradictory, the return of the command line. It's powerful. It's good. And the nice thing about bots is it's a conversation, so the bot has a chance to teach you stuff. And so the Azure bot is actually a good example of this, where it does some NLP, but it also just handles commands. Once you get good at that thing, you don't want to type in English. You want to tell it exactly what to do. And so there's a real opportunity to do that. Also, simple commands like help and cancel and stuff like that. I'm just going to briefly mention text analytics. It's my favorite of the cognitive services right now. So we have a colleague who is considered grumpy. And we had a number of colleagues who started taking his emails and running them through text analytics, which tells you it tells you how positive their response is. It's called sentiment analysis. And so it gives you a number from 0 to 1. And he proved that he was, in fact, not grumpy, because all of his statements were above 50%. It also pulls out some of the key phrases and stuff. And this is maybe not something you would use directly in a bot. But you can imagine you're having a conversation with a bot, and you're getting more and more irritated because it's feeling more and more like a phone tree, and it's not understanding your natural language, and you start swearing. If you can run sentiment analysis on each thing, you may have a great opportunity to bail and say, tell you what, I'm going to hook you up to a person now. So it's very helpful. So we're almost at the end here. I wanted to leave you with a little bit of wisdom, and then if we have time, I'll take some questions. First of all, and most importantly, I cannot emphasize how early we are in this whole process. It is just beginning. And there's almost no part of this whole ecosystem that's going to look even recognizable in about 5 years. So this is a good thing to know. I'm not saying bury your head in the sand for the next 5 years. In fact, I'm saying the opposite. I think everybody should be building bots and playing with the channels and understanding it. I think there's definitely opportunity for many of you and many of your companies to use this stuff now. And many of you, it's not. In fact, one of my favorite parts of my job is convincing people not to use bots, because it is really not for everybody. And when Satya got on stage and at Build and said, this is a you know the next frontier, he got everybody excited. And so every CEO said to their staff, go investigate this bot thing. We made a lot of work for a lot of people, so I'm sorry. But the truth is there really is some opportunity. Even a year ago, if you had said to me, should your company use bots, I would say definitely not. And now I can't say definitely not, because sometimes now there's some opportunity. Specifically in NLP, fast evolving, speech. Speech is kind of a problem right now. People get excited about speech because it kind of sounds like the science fictional future we all want to live in. We all want to be on a computer. Sorry. Speech is, like, it's okay. In fact, Microsoft just had a big thing about how its speech recognition is top of the pile. But speech is great when you have really good microphones and you can control the acoustic environment and your accent is somewhere near whatever neutral is, which seems like a horrible thing to say. It turns out it is kind of very error-prone otherwise. And so don't jump into speech feet first. It's one of the things it's experimenting with. Again, there are situations where speech can really work for you, but don't assume it's just a slam dunk. I would say conversational logic is someplace that there can be huge advances yet to come. I think the Microsoft Bot Builder is a good start, but I think it could be sleeker. It particularly doesn't do a good job, and we're really aware of this, of a situation where a user kind of like changes topics. And you say, I want ice cream, and the bot says, well, what flavor do you want, vanilla, chocolate, or strawberry? And it says, what time does the pool open? Right? And even humans sometimes, you know, the smoke starts coming out of our ears, but bots in particular are really bad at handling that kind of stuff. The channels are moving so fast, in terms of capabilities and formatting and stuff, protocols. It is a little hard to keep up with, and that's the situation. We really are back at the browser wars. And the users. There are no paradigms. They don't know what to do. Like, the kids have a certain example, have certain ideas of how they should be expected to do it. But for the most part, all of these user interface conventions that we've built really painstakingly over the last 20 years with the web have been thrown out the window. On the web, you have this idea of progress. There's a back button, maybe even breadcrumbs, you know, at the top of a web page. I think my mom probably still doesn't understand breadcrumbs. And now we're switching to a thing where the amount of context you have is just kind of the stream of bubbles. So there's a lot of educating them and figuring out these conventions and figuring out the UI. We're just at the beginning. And I want to say there's not really a hard and fast definition of what a bot is, and that I'm okay with that. Our colleague Matt says bots are just apps. I think that's pretty good. They're apps used through a certain type of interface. They don't have to use natural language. They can use command lines. They could use images. The bar is, what are you going to do to make your users' lives better? And whatever that is, if a bot does it, that's great. No matter what your friends say, if they're teasing you because it's not a bot, don't listen to them. You get to decide. Have fun. This is a pretty exciting time to be here at the beginning of a new user interface paradigm. So how are we doing for time? We're doing okay. I probably have about 5 minutes for questions if you have any. So I think what you're asking is about, I'm gonna try to paraphrase. I think you're talking about asynchronicity, that right now bots seem like the user asks something and a bot responds. And sometimes you want a bot that will just talk to the user even when the user isn't talking. Is that where you're going with that?
I imagine myself writing a piece of code for something else, not just interacting with the user.
Right. So, and I will tell you my own personal opinion, which is that bots are just event handlers. And one of those events might be message from the users, but there's all sorts of events, and it's going to deal with them. And one of the events that it can spit out is a message to a user, but it could do other stuff too. So again, a bot is just an app. There's no hard and fast definition for what it is. And obviously the most common thing is going to be interacting with users via chats, but it could certainly stray pretty far from that, and you'll still be in the bot club in my book. Yep. So the question is, can you have a bot that'll do tasks for you?
Yeah.
It all depends how you hook it up. So I certainly don't know a way to have a bot with Facebook Messenger and have it do tasks for me. But the interface between the web chat client and the bot framework is an interface called Direct Line, and you can connect that from anything, from an iOS device. You could have a web page that connects to a bot directly. And now you can have messages coming down from the bot, which you can interpret however you want. So that depends how you hook it up. But I think you'll see, especially with the new web chat client, we've made that kind of stuff easier, at least for dealing with web pages. Yes? So I think your question is, who actually develops the bot? Who trains the bot?
Who trains the bot?
Yeah. That all depends what you mean by bot. You could be talking about training the natural language part of it. Yeah. Good question. Right now, it's a bunch of engineers sitting around, and it's funny because these are the people who probably have fewer human conversations than anybody. And I've actually seen them do it, and they're terrible at it. And so you're right. We need conversational specialists. We just created a new job. Congratulations. How do you train the NLP with different languages? By starting all over again. I know, it's great. So you create a new model with a new language, and there are different language support. There's Japanese, there's a bunch of others, and they're adding them. But they have basically different language parsing, different word breaking. But you do it by creating the same intents with new. So right now, there's not even at the high level an idea that these two models, the English model and the Japanese model, are using the same intents. So right now, there's no connection between them. You're really just creating a brand new model that happens to have the same intents. And then in your code, you can index to the right one. One of the things with text analytics is recognizing language. So you could actually have a single bot that, depending on the first thing the user says, we can recognize it, say, oh, that's Japanese, and switch to the Japanese model. But it is, in terms of the work and in terms of the specialty we just created, it is starting all over. So that's lifetime employment for the conversational specialists. Back there. How do you interface it? Tiago's going to show you in the next session. Yes?
In terms of user experience, do you recommend your bot pretends to be human?
No, I recommend not that your bot pretend to be human. There's a huge uncanny valley problem with bots. You don't want them to try to be humans because we know they're not. And we just get frustrated, annoyed, we feel like we're being lied to. So don't. In fact, my advice is just the opposite. Like, have a persona for your bot that it's like slightly addled and well-meaning. Right? It's a trainee. Like, it's doing its best, but come on, it barely understands English or whatever. Lower expectations is a really good place to start, and have your bot really tell the people, this is what I do and this is what I can't do. Sorry, I'm in training. Seriously, like, lower expectations. Yeah, back there. Almost none of them integrate with search, and they hit the wall really fast on the natural language stuff. So this is kind of breaking news that, oh my gosh, why aren't we using search for everything? I think we should be using search for almost everything. Yep. It could be. In my mind, the bot is just an event handler. And so in that, absolutely. Kind of depends how you structure it, how things are hooked up. There's a serious lack of plumbing, especially on the client side for this stuff right now. Sure. Yep. Yep. Yeah, so the question is, can you nest bots? And we are experiencing with partners that this is what they want to do, especially because big companies tend to have these organizational silos where this is the restaurant reservations bot, and we don't even talk to the the room service bot. Those are two different things, but you want to kind of have a single user interface for it all. And right now we don't do a particularly good job of nesting that, but now we're really, really aware that that need exists. Yep. That's really up to your web service. It's a web service, so it can be very, very fast. The bot framework itself is very, very lightweight, so it's passing stuff through extremely quickly. So the amount of added latency is relatively low. NLP, I don't have any answers for you on the NLP. It's reasonably fast. I think it's sort of acceptable right now, but most of it has to do with how your web service is plumbed. I think we have time for maybe one more question. Yeah. Well, so there's two kinds of errors in the NLP. One is there's an error, and the other is it just got it wrong. It doesn't think it made an error. And really, everything is just probabilities. It's just saying, you know, it's not making any promises. It's saying, look, buddy, I said it was 72%. I didn't say it was the law. And so that's up to you to manage. Yeah. Any more? Is somebody on fire and has to ask that one last question? Yes. Can you nest intents? Tiago's nodding. They keep adding features to Lewis. I know you can nest entities. Yeah. I don't think you can nest intents. It doesn't quite make sense to me, but I think I saw a thing about children in there, so now I don't know. I'll have to go look it up. All right, thank you all for coming out.